Right, so the aim of tonight's meeting is to raise awareness of Solvency 2, to encourage participation in Quiz 3, the quantitative impact study, which is just about to get going, to raise awareness of the work of the group consultative in achieving European consensus, and perhaps most importantly, to give you the chance to express your views. And with this in mind, we've invited a very distinguished panel along to deliver presentations on each of those four aspects, and hopefully to encourage plenty of discussion. discourage discussion in other places, but not here. Right, so I'll introduce our panellists. First of all, on my far right, Sarah Varney, who's Solvency II Project Manager at the Financial Services Authority. On my immediate right, Catherine Morgan is Chair of the UK Professions Non-Life Solvency II Working Group. On my immediate left, David Hare is Chair of the UK Professions Solvency II Life Working Group. And finally, on my far left, Rolf Stolting, manager of the Group Consultatives project on Solvency 2. So welcome to all our panellists, and I'd now like to hand over to Sarah Varney to give us a general overview of Solvency 2.
Okay.
Sarah.
I presume it's best if I do it over there, is it?
I think it might be, yes.
Okay. Is it these buttons? Hi, I have a relatively easy job tonight, at least I hope. I'm going to give you just a bit of general background information on what the Solvency 2 project is and what stage it's reached, and then within that, what role Quiz 3 has. And you've already heard a little bit about the fact that we regard Quiz 3 as being quite an important event here. So thank you very much for inviting me, and it is a great pleasure to be here. I am not proposing personally particularly to cover in a great deal of detail what the content of Quiz 3 is and some of the issues that are currently topical within the Solvency 2 debate, but that's very much what Catherine and David are going to cover from the life and non-life perspectives respectively, and then obviously Rolf is going to give us a slightly more European group consultative angle on some of the issues as well. Firstly, from a UK stroke FSA perspective, I think if we talk about what our assessment of the Solvency 2 project currently is, where's it got to, how much progress has it made, and what are the outstanding issues, it's important just to recap briefly on what the objectives were that we had, still have, in terms of the Solvency 2 negotiations. Clearly in the UK we went through a process of domestic reform, and we've carried over the principles of that to what we've been seeking in Solvency 2. So we are seeking for Solvency 2 to be a three-pillar framework, and we are seeking within Solvency 2 to have an increased focus on the quality of a firm's risk management, that is, relative to Solvency 1. Appropriate incentives within the Solvency 2 framework to encourage firms to do those well and to ensure that supervisors focus on the importance of risk management. As I said, Solvency 2 will be a three-pillar framework, so I thought I'd just recap briefly on what those pillars are. And there are some differences in how you might think about Solvency 2 and the sort of structure of the current domestic regime, slight difference of emphasis. Within Pillar 1, there will be asset and liability valuation standards, and clearly one very important aspect of that will be the technical provisions standard. There will be a minimum capital requirement, or MCR, which is supposed to be a level of supervisory intervention that's kind of the ultimate level. In other words, if a firm breaches that level of capital, it would expect to be put into runoff. And then the normal operating level of capital would be the solvency capital requirement. And within Solvency II, there will be a hierarchy of ways in which that can be calculated. The default option, in essence, is what's called the standard approach or the standard formula. But in addition, there will be the option for firms to use their own internal models, subject to getting those approved by the regulator, or indeed for smaller firms, and work on this is ongoing, they're not fully developed yet, there will be simplified requirements. In addition, there will be Pillar 2, and that in a Solvency II context means the whole of the supervisory review process, but which, so in UK terms, that's really thinking about ARROW and ICAS together, but there is still obviously within that Pillar 2 process the ability for supervisors to require a capital add-on to the Pillar 1 capital requirements. And Pillar 3 will encompass both enhanced public disclosure and revamped supervisory reporting. One other important thing to appreciate about Solvency II is that it will be what's termed a Lamfalussy directive, in contrast to the Banking Capital Requirements Directive. What that means is that the broad architecture and principles and key parameters will be set out in what's called the Level 1 Framework Directive, and then underpinning that will be Level 2 implementing measures, which give greater detail on how those key aspects will be implemented. And quite a lot will fall to be implementing measures in Solvency II, so a number of the key formulae will actually be expressed as implementing measures, although the calibration for those and the general structure of those will be set out in the Level 1 text. And that appreciating that is important for understanding sort of what stage the Solvency II project has got to now and what the ongoing bits of work are, and what role Quiz 3 will play in shaping those requirements. In terms of what the FSA's role is in Solvency II, the FSA is a member of SEOPS, which is the Committee of European Insurance and Occupational Pension Supervisors. And that is an organisation which provides technical advice to the Commission. It is actually the Commission who holds the pen on drafting the Framework Directive proposal, and then that is subsequently negotiated in the Council of Ministers, by the finance ministries, and in the European Parliament. So that brings me on to the timetable and where we are now. There's quite a lot of work that's been done on Solvency II. In terms of SEOPS producing advice to the Commission on the drafting of the Level 1 Directive, and we're expecting the formal proposal of the Level 1 Directive to emerge probably in July this year. And as I said, that will then go into the co-decision process negotiated in the European Parliament and the Council of Ministers. In addition, SEOPS is running its third quantitative impact study, and we hope that the specification will be sent out to firms at the beginning of April, and then firms will have between April and June to consider the results of that, and they will send the results into the FSA. The FSA will analyse those and produce an analysis that's sent to SEOPS, and the SEOPS report will emerge maybe late October, early November of this year. In terms of the implementing measures, the Level 2 measures that I talked about, work on those is already progressing within SEOPS, and it's important to appreciate that. So SEOPS hasn't kind of put its tools down and gone into hibernation until the Level 1 text is agreed. The work on the implementing measures is ongoing, but clearly it will be influenced by whatever changes there are that come through on the Level 1 text. And then, you know, when do we expect the end of all this to be? When do we expect firms actually to have to implement Solvency II? Well, current best guess is probably 2011. So then that brings me on to quiz three, and I just wanted to set out what the scope of that would be, and to note two key differences from what was in quiz two in terms of coverage. It will, as quiz two did, cover technical provisions, also the minimum capital requirement and the solvency capital requirement, the new bits tested in a much more systematic fashion than they were in quiz two are own funds or available capital and group capital requirements. There are a number of other things to note, I guess, about quiz three, just briefly. In terms of technical provisions, clearly in quiz two there were two options tested. In quiz three, that has now converged to an agreement on a market-consistent valuation standard, at least for hedgeable risks, and for non-hedgeable risks, those are calculated as a best estimate plus a cost of capital risk margin. Now, I said quiz three is quite important, and I just wanted to say why I think it is important. From the FSA's perspective, or from the UK's perspective, one reason for it being important is that it will undoubtedly be influential on negotiations. It will be influential on level one text. We can expect that the quiz three results will emerge just as the negotiations are beginning. And it's obviously also very important for the ongoing development of the implementing measures, and I would sort of highlight in particular the calibration of the solvency capital requirement. But also from your perspective, I think that quiz three will give you a good measure of what it's going to be like to implement Solvency II. It will be a good way to get Solvency II on your board agenda, and it will be a good opportunity to do some sort of gap analysis between where you are today and where you will need to be by 2011. From a policy perspective, just to round up on some of the open issues in terms of Solvency II negotiation, at least from a UK perspective, where we think that quiz three will be quite influential. In terms of the level one directive text and the minimum capital requirement, there is still ongoing discussion about what is the appropriate level of calibration for the minimum capital requirement and what form should that calculation take. Now, quiz three will test two options. It will test a revised modular formula, which is currently SIOP's preference, and indeed, from what I've seen of discussions amongst the finance ministries, probably the majority preference there as well. But it will also test the so-called CEA compact approach. In terms of own funds, what will be in quiz three will essentially be directly what is in the current draft of the level one text. So to the extent that there are issues that emerge from that, then there are obviously issues that need to be resolved in the level one text. And clearly in respect of group requirements and the groups debate more generally, very topical at the moment in Solvency II, it's going to be important, I think, and influential on that debate that firms demonstrate that they can identify and measure group diversification benefits and indeed deal sensibly with group capital transferability issues. In terms of development of the implementing measures, which I mentioned earlier on, clearly there will be a substantial implementing measure giving more detail on the technical provisions standard, and there will also be, in effect, the solvency capital requirement standard formula will be an implementing measure. And indeed, there will be ongoing work on the calibration of the various factors. Now, just to round up, I thought it only fair, since I've just asked you all to do lots of work on Quiz 3, to say actually what the FSA is doing to help with this. We have, during March, held a number of workshops in conjunction with a number of the trade associations, and indeed there are a couple more ABI workshops coming up in April, and we're very grateful to the ABI for organising those. In addition, throughout the quiz exercise, we will post on the FSA website and indeed on the CEOPS website answers to frequently asked questions. And indeed, I've also given you there the email address that will get you in direct contact with our FSA policy experts who can help you with any queries that you've got. In addition, I did mention that there is ongoing work on the calibration of the SCR, and in particular, I think we need to look at the calibration of the underwriting risk modules, the factors within those. And we are generally encouraging firms, where they have internal models, in addition to kind of filling in the box that says what's the answer to this Solvency II formula that CEOPS has set out, also to give us your internal models numbers. And we will be doing a certain amount of work with firms who are happy to give us internal models numbers so that we can ensure that we're getting those numbers on a like-for-like basis and obviously do some productive work on calibration. Thanks. That's all I wanted to say.
Very good. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Sarah. Now I'd like to ask Catherine Morgan to tell us about Solvency II for general insurers.
Thank you, Nick. I've been working on Solvency II for about 5 or 6 years now, roughly since my daughter was born, and she'll be 10 when it comes in. And I'm wondering whether she'll actually be a qualified actuary in time for Solvency III. Personally, I have to say I'm massively impressed with the ambition in Solvency II and the level of consultation from the FSA, from CEOPS, from the European Commission, and the enthusiasm and engagement of all the key players. I think it's going to be a fantastic piece of legislation. And personally, it's a privilege to be involved on behalf of the profession, chairing the UK group on non-life insurance and feeding into the group consultative, who are doing some really good work as well. As far as my group are concerned, there are four key issues which are exercising our minds at the moment. And when we come on to the debate, I'd be interested to know if there are other issues that you think we should be engaging with. These are the four that we think are important. Best estimate provisions for general insurance is a new area for the profession and for the industry in the UK. It wasn't really a focus of work under ICAS, which focused on capital. So it's really exciting that it's taking up a lot of thought in Solvency II. The General Insurance Board has done a lot of work on this over the last couple of years through the GRIP project. This is really, really key for solvency assessment. If you're a regulator, then you really want to know that reserves are calculated on a consistent basis across different companies and different member states. So for general insurance, what this means is that best estimates need to be calculated as a mean and also discounted, which again is very, very new for the UK. So there are some issues. The first one is, how do you calculate a best estimate provision? Now, initially, CEOPS thought, and in their draft for Quiz 3, suggested that this should be the highest of two actuarial estimates, which clearly isn't a best estimate. Now, the group consultative have engaged quite heavily with CEOPS on this and have convinced them that that's not the right thing to do, so that's a really good win for the group. My working group has produced a paper on considerations for assessing best estimate provisions, which is on the FSA website now, so if you're doing Quiz 3, it's there to give you some advice. It's also an issue for small companies that don't have a lot of experience of setting provisions. How on earth do they go around setting best estimate discounted provisions? One of the approaches is that they would use a proxy method, and Rolf is going to talk about how that's being tackled across Europe in more detail. It's not something in the UK that we're generally in favour of, but the FSA have asked the Board for Actuarial Standards to look at this in more detail, And the BAS is setting up a group chaired by Julian Lowe, who's on the board, to look at this in more detail. And I will be getting involved in that on behalf of the profession. The second issue I want to talk about is reserve margins. And again, this is another new area of focus. Most UK general insurance companies do have margins in their provisions, but it's a very opaque process, and they're inconsistent between different companies. So the aim in Solvency II is to have transparency and a consistent approach. Now, the initial thinking was to copy the Australian approach and use percentiles. But now, as Sarah mentioned, we're moving on to a cost of capital approach, which is an attempt to proxy a market value of liabilities. This is what's used in Switzerland, so there is some experience to look at. Now, there are some issues with this, of course. It's not a guarantee of adequacy of the provisions. And another interesting issue is, which capital do you use the cost of? So if you're a large, well-diversified insurance company, you might be expected to have a lower capital value relative to a company that's not as well diversified. So if you're using cost of capital, you might want to use your own capital level. But because you're trying to work out the value of how much you're going to sell your liabilities for, it should be the capital for the company you're notionally selling to. So there is a concept of using a reference company, a kind of a standard generic non-life insurance company, to assess what capital to use. Quiz 3 suggests using your own company, but using the SCR formula rather than your internal model as a proxy for this. And it is still a live issue. The International Actuarial Association has a working group looking at reserves and reserve margins, and that's being supported from the UK by a GIRO working party chaired by Martin White. They've concluded that cost of capital is probably the most sensible and practical approach to this, and some of their thinking might lead you to conclude that percentiles are particularly inappropriate. So the move away from percentiles in Solvency II is a good one. And cost of capital is not perfect, but nobody's thought of anything better yet, so it seems a sensible way to go. Another current issue that we're thinking about is the allowance for future profits in the SCR formula. So when you're working out your solvency capital requirement, you can use a standard formula or an internal model, or you can replace elements of the standard formula with a partial model. Now, previous iterations of the formula included an allowance for future profits on profitable business, and you set that off against your capital requirement. Now the new formula, or the latest version that I've seen, doesn't allow you to do that, so that this element has disappeared. And it may well change when Quiz 3 comes out next week, but the principle is quite interesting, because if something isn't in the formula, then you can't replace it with a partial model. So you have to think quite carefully about exactly what's in the formula, because you might end up having to effectively do a full internal model to achieve something that you think is quite sensible. And this is an issue, because for small companies, they might not have the resources to set up a full internal model. If you're not allowed to allow for future profits, then it introduces an element of additional prudence into the capital assessment, which maybe isn't intended to be there. And because it's looking as though under Solvency II we'll have to have approval of models, not just the capital that comes out of them, then that means that building your model is going to require more effort than under ICAS already. So this is another live issue. And then the last issue I want to touch on is the one-year confidence level. So the solvency capital requirement is calibrated at 99.5% VAR over a one-year time period. Now, what's not really been brought out for me is what the issue is for reserves there. I mean, if you're modelling your reserves, what you'd really like to know, particularly as a policyholder, for example, is that the reserves are adequate to run off, not just for a one-year time period. Now, Martin White and I did some work on this last year, and we believe that if you look at your reserves at 99.5% confidence over 1 year, then over 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, actually the percentage goes down quite a lot and quite quickly. So it is really important to look at reserves to run off rather than just over a one-year time horizon. And again, it's not clear how this is being tackled in the SCR formula. So those are the four issues that keep me awake at night. I would be interested to know which ones you're interested in, whether it's the same four or different four. There's still lots to resolve on Solvency II. As Sarah mentioned, the implementation measures are still being worked on. So I would echo what she said to say, get involved, do quiz three, and give feedback to the FSA and to SEOPS. And then at the end of the day, we can deliver a really, really good prudential supervision regime. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Catherine. Now, we have a geographically diverse group of speakers tonight, and they're speaking in order of how far their place of work is away from Staple Inn. So we started with Sarah, who's based in Canary Wharf, then moved to Catherine, who's based in Manchester, and now we go north of the border to David Hare, who is based in Edinburgh. And David is going to talk to us about Solvency II for life insurers. David.
Thanks very much, Nick. And as a fellow of the other actuarial body based in the UK, it's nice to be here at Staple Inn. A lot of the issues that I'll be talking about are very similar to the issues that Catherine's been talking about, because, of course, Solvency II is for life and non-life insurers. And there are some very particular non-life topics that Catherine's pulled out, and there are a couple of particular life issues that I'll talk about, but some of the stuff will be sort of a general picture, which I hope will be helpful. When we were putting these slides together, we were thinking, you know, what are the key issues we want to pull out so that for people who aren't quite as familiar with all the sort of the Solvency II bandwagon, that at least you'll have a kind of a snapshot of what the issues are that are currently under debate, because some things have actually been resolved, you'll be glad to know, in the 2 or 3 years that the Solvency II project has really been gathering momentum. These are kind of the four big things that I think about, the margin and technical provisions, then the capital requirements that sit on top, and then some issues to do with groups, and some issues to do with disclosure. And the two I'd like to talk about particularly, because that's what we've been doing on the life side, the working party of the life board that we've had since last summer, we've been doing some work on the technical provision side of things, and we've been doing some work on K-factors and with-profits business. So, of course, being a Scot and a simple soul, though maybe I shouldn't say that about all my fellow companions north of the border, I think in pictures. So here's a picture, and those of you who think graphically, you'll appreciate this if you can see it from the back. This is a picture taken from one of the SEOPS consultation papers, CP20, and this is basically how Pillar 1 works, whether you're life or non-life. And the idea here, you see that you know, the sort of the stacked bar on the right, the top bar is the sort of the solvency capital requirement that Sarah talked about. And within that, there'll be the minimum capital requirement, the sort of we'll send the boys in level if you breach. And then below that, you've got technical provisions. Now, technical provisions come in two flavours, and that's why, if you like, there's a sort of a left and a right-hand side to that bar. And it kind of just graphically summarises what Solvency II is trying to achieve. That on the right-hand side, you're going to have best estimate, by which is meant the mean of a distribution, and then you've got a risk margin that sits on top. Unless, of course, there's a hedge available, in which case, why don't you just value the hedge? So the left-hand side is the market-consistent value of the hedgeable assets. Now, the reason I pull that out on the life side is, you know, is it clear which side of that lower stack bar everything falls into? And the answer is, not at the moment. Here's the latest definition on hedgeable from the QIS 3 pretest spec. And it defines hedgeable as being something that's got a sufficient, deep, liquid and transparent market that a firm could rapidly execute large volume transactions with little impact on prices. Now, maybe at some areas of the derivative space you could do that, but there are some areas where you certainly couldn't. And so the problem is that in the UK we're happily valuing the time value of the cost of guarantees. We're working on that, extrapolating the market out, because we know the market doesn't exist in 60-year options. So we're sort of pretending how it would behave if it was there. And that's working fine, we think, in the UK. We value that in the balance sheet. Our auditors audit it, and everything's fine. I'm not sure it passes the letter of this definition. So that's one of the issues. Now, what I'm not quite sure is whether it would really matter in terms of the numbers on your balance sheet, and is it just sort of a hassle of system development, or is there a real issue here? But that's one of them. Now, in terms of the SCR, this solvency capital requirement, the way it's built up is in this modular form, where you work out the capital at risk, or the risk capital that you need for lots of subcomponents of the different risks. So, for example, the SCR market, the second one on the left-hand side there, there's your market risk capital, and it will be made up of capital for equity risk, for interest rate risk, for property risk, all this sort of thing. And then these things get correlated together by a correlation matrix that correlates capital requirements rather than one that correlates risks within a separate sort of model. And then you build this all up until you get the capital that you need for all your different risks, and you correlate all of that together, and eventually you end up with an SCR. The trouble is, what happens if it's with profits business and you can profit share with the policyholders? And there's been various attempts at doing this. The Quiz 2, those of you who did Quiz 2 will know about the K factor, which was basically a kind of end piece adjustment to quantify how much of the risk capital would effectively be provided for by policyholders in lower terminal bonuses. The trouble is, to get that number right, you really need to work out what the terminal bonuses would have been pre and post the profit sharing and then back solve. So we can do that in the UK. But the whole idea is this is to make it simple for people who can't work out the numbers I've just talked about. So there's been a separate attempt at a refinement of this for Quiz 3 that basically says, yes, you can allow for profit sharing within these components, but you've got to make sure that you, when you're working at the profit sharing in each of the components, you keep a note of how much it would be. You then correlate together the components without allowing for profit sharing, and then at the end, the last piece you take off is basically the largest profit sharing that you ever got in any of your subcomponents. Now, the trouble is, the more subcomponents you have, the smaller the profit sharing will be in any particular one, so there's no guarantee that this is going to end up with the right answer. So what we've been doing in the Life Working Group is doing some work on this, and we've had various helpful discussions with the FSA. I mean, we recognise this is a difficult issue to try and squeeze UK with profits business into a framework that is meant to suit participating business right across Europe. So with the best of intentions, I suspect we're not quite there yet, but some good work has been done. Of course, what will then happen is if this doesn't work for UK offices, then UK offices could then go down the internal model route. And that's quite a difficult issue potentially, because we think within the UK that we've got ICAS, and aren't we good? We are well on the way to a Solvency II type valuation. And in many respects that's true, except that the picture of an internal model for capital requirements, for solvency capital requirement measurement, is, you know, a much bigger thing than the ICAS regime, big though that was for us when it was first brought in, and still is for us. And one speaker from CEOPS was saying, well, basically the UK, you're at primary school just now, you need to get to university. So it's that big a jump. So, you know, those of you who work for life officers like myself, it'd be well worth thinking about, you know, what are we doing to develop an internal model? Should we decide to do it because we have to get the right capital requirement, rather than because we want to, because it's actually a good way of running our business? Hopefully we'll be in the latter camp, but, you know, the former camp will probably exist. So certainly within the UK profession, we've been working on with profits. We've been trying to also produce some educational material to just quantify some of the different issues that need to be thought about in developing policy. So we've been writing about risk margins, particularly on the life side. We've been writing about technical provisions and some of the issues for best estimates there. Some of that material is nearly finished, and in due course we'll put it on the website, and hopefully it will prove of use. We haven't been doing anything on group issues. It's a particularly fraught issue for some of the very big companies to what extent they'll be allowed to recognise diversification benefits locally. That will probably come up in discussion, so that's enough on that. And we've talked a bit about Pillar 3 disclosure. There's fun and games there in terms of how much will need to be disclosed of non-compliance with capital requirements. And if you breach your SCR or non-comply, which is the new, slightly softer shorter phrase. When will you have to tell the market? And things like that. And certainly the Commission are very keen on as open disclosure as possible from the industry. Some of the other issues that are worth just noting, again, some of these are not just life, but they're non-life, but it's worth mentioning. Prudent Person Plus is code for trusting management to run the company, but not entirely. And putting some sort of fixed limits around what management can do. So it is possible that our friends, the admissibility rules, will travel through, or some variation of that will travel through into Solvency II, at least for some time. Alignment with the IASB, I'm sure that's another topic for a sessional meeting once the Phase 2 paper comes out. But some of the best estimate that we might use in the UK for with profits may or may not be how the IASB go, depending on you know, which way the wind blows. Eligible capital tiers, Sarah mentioned that. That is something that people may want to watch in Quiz 3 to understand how their capital fits in the structure being proposed by SEOPS just now. We haven't done anything on that in the Solvency II Working Party, since to a certain extent that's very much a company-specific thing. What we have tried to do is, the last two things, is trying to get the small company voice to be heard. And some of the members of the working group have day-to-day experience of working with smaller companies, and we're doing some research into, you know, proxy methods for dealing particularly with profits business and what that might mean for SCR results for the smaller companies. And then, of course, the last thorny issue is, should actuaries have reserved roles? And there are some very strong views in the Commission which say, no, you don't have reserved roles for lawyers or for accountants, so why should you have them for actuaries? On the other hand, of course, the actuarial skill set is something very important to have in running life and non-life insurance companies. So there's still a little bit of debate on to what extent the word actuary, rather than just actuarial techniques, will appear in the directive. I don't know whether you can give us anything encouraging on that as I hand over now to Rolf, because I know that the group consultative, and I sit on the insurance committee as well, like Catherine for the UK, we've been discussing that, to what extent we could encourage the Commission to recognise how useful actuaries are as well as actuarial techniques. So at this stage, I'm going to hand over to Rolf.
Thank you very much, David. And for our final panellist this evening, we go outside the UK to Germany, and we're particularly pleased that Rolf Stolting, who is manager of the Group Consultative Solvency II project, or working group, has joined us to speak to us this evening. And Rolf is going to talk about the European actuarial perspective. Over to you.
Thank you very much for inviting me in this session meeting. And as you already mentioned, you are going to go more and more far and far away from London, and the language, the knowledge of the English language, is also deteriorating more and more, I should say. First of all, I wanted to give you a small impression about the organization of the Solvency II process. You know probably already a lot of it, maybe even all, everything. You know that the EU Commission is in the driving seat for working out the legislation, the laws, the European laws. SEOPS is helping them, as Sarah mentioned already. And then SEOPS has built up five groups at the beginning, Pillar 1, Pillar 2, Pillar 3, and about groups. The Pillar 1 group was initially split up into life and non-life part, and then it has been merged. The Group Consultative, which is the organization of the European Actuarial Associations, mirrored immediately at the beginning of Solvency II this organization, this working group organization, with the five working groups. We did not merge the Pillar 1 groups, life and non-life, because we think from the actuarial point of view, a lot of questions are either life or non-life, and the overlap is rather small. Therefore, it is probably more boring if you are dealing with life questions where non-life activities are there, and vice versa. These five groups continue to exist, and what was very important in the beginning of this project, that there was a lot of working context on the working level, and we achieved to do this. Therefore, our working groups have a lot of context to the working group level of SEOPS, which is very good, and I think this is a good way to fulfill our mission, which is to give technical advice to within the development of Solvency II. Well, and then there are, of course, other players like the ECA, which is a lobbying organization. Group Positive is not a lobbying organization, and then CEO Forum and so on. Our guidelines are within the Solvency II process, are summed up to the main guidelines here. We see Solvency II, well, a main goal of Solvency II for us is the security for the policyholder at the end. Within Europe, this was for a long time also the number one goal. Then there was a slight change, by the way. And now within Europe, the Europe-wide harmonization in order to create a level playing field became, I think, number one, and then comes the policyholder. It's interesting to see this move, by the way. Of course, we think also that a risk-based system, risk-based principles, should be there within Solvency II, and there should also be market consistency, because, of course, we actuaries, we know the truth and we want the truth, but we are all paid by the industry companies, by the insurance companies, and therefore the industry is working in a market, and therefore there must be a market consistency. This is very simple. And we are, I mentioned already, we see ourselves, and we are a professional organization, and we are not a lobby organization. This means especially that we cannot, really, we cannot give and provide significant help for purely political decisions. Even if SEOPS tries to do this and to ask us, can't you help us, sometimes this is not possible for us, and we don't want to do it. Otherwise, we would lose our credibility. Well, there are some key questions. You heard a lot of them already. What about, key questions which are remaining now? Acceptance of diversification of the for the calculation of the solvency capital requirement. Of course, everybody wants to acknowledge and to accept diversification effects, because otherwise the insurance industry would not exist. Insurance is, I think, not nothing else but the main reason for the insurance to exist is that diversification exists, and not to acknowledge this would be foolish. The problem is, to which extent will this be recognized? The problem is that in very bad times, diversification is different than in good times. Certainly something about the non-linearity, and this is the underlying problem here, the non-linearity of the dependency structure. SCR and MCR, should the MCR be a percentage of the SCR, yes or no? Or if yes, it's simple, then everybody has to calculate the SCR, and the MCR is very simple to get to it. Or should the MCR be in some sense a very simplified formula in comparison to the SCR? This is a question. I think this has not been decided up to now. The risk of natural catastrophes, which are rather important within Europe, is, there are beginnings of looking at it in a more detailed way, but there's certainly a lot of work to do for these natural catastrophes. The problems for the natural catastrophes is that we have some catastrophes which are Europe-wide, or which touch some countries, like a European storm is going over UK, Belgium, Netherlands, Germany, for example. And you have others, earthquake in Greece, for example, very important for Greece, but not for UK nor for Germany. It's far very remote. But you have to look at a comparable evaluation of both of all these natural catastrophes, otherwise you have no harmonization. Then the big question, how to improve internal models for solvency II, or the even bigger question is, what is an internal model? There are several, and we have had already some discussions, there are several ideas about internal models. You can say nearly everything is an internal model, or you can say internal models are extremely high, complex, very sophisticated, and so on. Whereas the tools, what's the definition? Then technical provisions. Especially in non-life, the problem of technical provisions has turned out to be a, how would I say, a little bit of a controversial problem. And I think this was one of the results of Quiz 1, where I must be very careful now, where the impression was that the best estimate plus risk margin in comparison to the reserves or the technical provisions which you can find in the local balance sheets, there were different levels, there were different gaps. And this is a problem for the harmonization. And this, by the way, is interesting. It's a problem, a real European problem. If you talk to American, Australian, Canadian actuaries who all want to develop new solvency systems, of course, everybody must know what you put, how much capital you need for your technical provisions, because only the rest is available for SCR. They have not the problem because they say, even if it's wrong, but we take our balance sheet, because they have only one balance sheet rule within their country, and they take it, and even if it's not the best estimate plus risk margin, but everybody makes something very similar. This is not the case in Europe. As I said already, Quiz 1 showed that there are bigger differences across countries. If you take the balance sheet from the UK or from France or from Germany or another country, you may have bigger gaps, differences to the best estimate plus risk margin. And in order to harmonize, to get a harmonized system, you have therefore to harmonize the technical provisions. This problem has been shown by the Group Constatif and has been put on the table by the Group Constatif and has been taken up rather lately, by the way, by CIRTS. Probably because they had a lot of other problems, but also because this is a difficult problem. For actuaries, this is clear. For non-actuaries, this is maybe a little bit not so clear, and it's more a problem of auditors, for example, in different countries. And now it became an actuarial problem. Especially in some countries, and I heard even in the UK, I was astonished a little bit. Even UK, you do not have the sufficient actuarial knowledge for all companies. Maybe you do not have all sufficient data or the development triangles for the long tail business, for example. I don't know. In Germany, you do not have always these data. In France, neither in France. Therefore, two things will be done. First of all, CIRTS will ask, and all supervisors will certainly ask all companies to begin immediately to build up the necessary data to get in 10 years a development triangle for the business for the last 10 years, within 10 years, for example. This is one thing, but the other problem is within 10 years, hopefully, we have already solvency too. And what do we do in the meantime? And therefore, even though we as actuaries don't like to do bad things, and a proxy for this calculation is, of course, a bad thing because it's not real pure actuarial work. But in spite of this fact, we as Group Constatif said we have to help CIRPS and the EU here in order to get a harmonized system rather quickly. Therefore, we will help to build up to proceed to build up to make proxy calculations for Europe. And for this, in order to do this, there will working groups be created, and I think in UK you just created it.
Just a bit.
This is just being done now.
Yeah.
This, in Germany they began 1 month ago, in France I think 4 months ago already. And these three biggest nations in Europe will be the first nations where we will have some experience on a national level with the participation. This was our proposition to SEOPs of actuaries, industry and supervisors. They will be work out a national proxy solution, so-called national proxy solution, because we have differences concerning culture, laws, concerning balance sheets, for example. Therefore, this must first of all be a national proxy. And then, of course, you have the problem how to harmonize these national proxies. And for this difficult harmonization exercise, there will be a group installed, co-chaired by SEOPS and Group Consultative, in order to do this difficult job, in order to harmonize the results of the different national groups and to give some guidance also for these groups and for the other countries, which has to be done. Well, quiz three, a lot of things have already been mentioned. We have been involved in the technical preparation of quiz three. For us, the main difficulties, and this is the experience from quiz two, is the level of the needed technical knowledge within the companies, especially smaller companies and smaller countries have a lot of difficulties. The data availability is a big problem for countries and companies, and especially the smaller countries have a lot of problems which you don't have in the UK. There's no translation available for them, and this is extremely difficult, and I think probably this is a problem which is very often underestimated in this country. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you very much, Rolf. Now, you've heard from our four panellists, and now it's your turn. The panel have given you a number of ideas of potential topics for discussion, but please don't feel restricted by those. And because we have all the experts here tonight, you should feel free to ask questions as well as to make your own comments. Can I, first of all, get an idea of how many people might like to say something or ask a question? One, two, three. Very good. Four. Right. We're doing all right then. Okay. A few more notes before we start. First of all, please don't let the fact that the meeting's being recorded deter you from contributing. Speakers will be given the chance to see their comments before they're published in the British Actuarial Journal. If time doesn't allow you to make your full comments, then you can submit them afterwards as a written contribution. And please ensure that you wait until the microphone is brought to you before making your contribution. And please state your name clearly before speaking. The president of the faculty last week pointed out that was a bit of a nonsense because you can't actually state your name before you start speaking, but I think it's reasonably clear what's intended. Can I ask Peter Wright to make the first contribution, please?
Thank you, President. You got the name right. I support the broad thrust of Solvency II. However, if I was seeking to pour cold water over the whole exercise, it wouldn't be difficult to point out the impossibility for most of the sub-risk modules proposed for Quiz 3 of selecting with any attempt at scientific accuracy the 99.5% one-year VAR. It's interesting that this objection has not been raised very widely, if at all. with most objections to the basic framework for the SCR coming from those supporters of a TAILVAR standard. TAILVAR is almost certainly a theoretically superior measure, but it's probably even harder to estimate. Now, in the UK, we have become used to applying a 99.5% one-year VAR standard for the ICAS. Of course, we too have faced the impossibility of deriving correct stress tests for the relevant risks. But a consensus view amongst the industry, actuarial profession, and the FSA on many of them has arisen over time. For equities, this consensus is that a fall of 40 to 45% is an appropriate stress test. I had suspected that continental supervisors would criticise this assumption, if at all, from the direction of requiring a larger fall, but I now see that we are talking about only a 35% fall for Quiz 3. Even worse, in my view, is the proposed 20% fall in property values. Can anyone really think that these stress tests represent one in 200-year events? Do these stress tests arrive from objective risk analysis or perhaps from political motives to encourage investment in equities and real estate? Are they driven by a feeling that sharp market falls will always be corrected in due course? If so, perhaps I could suggest that some of the SARPS members have spent too much time reading the articles and letters pages in the Actuary. This is a very dangerous assumption to make. So far, I've been talking about the SCR as calculated from the standard calculation. Of course, some companies, as been mentioned, will be hoping to use internal models to derive the whole, or I suspect in the vast majority of cases, part of the SCR. I'm currently unclear as to whether such companies will be able to assume lower levels of market volatility and lower correlations between markets than those incorporated in the standard calculations. And I look forward to the panel giving us some clarification on this. Before leaving the SCR, I'd also like to express surprise that in a system which aims for comprehensive risk coverage, there is no sub-risk module for changes in equity and fixed interest implied volatilities for use in the pricing of options and guarantees. Finally, turning to the calculation of technical provisions, I'm pleased to note that SARPS has elected for the cost of capital approach over the percentile approach for risk margins. This will at least make performing the calculations a practical possibility for most insurance companies. However, I am concerned at long-tail general insurance liabilities being granted an opt-out from the use of this cost of capital approach in Quiz 3. This, in my view, undermines the coherence of the whole system, and I'd be interested to have the rationale for it explained. I'd hope that any explanation was not simply that for these particular liabilities, the answers on the cost of capital approach were higher than the alternative percentile approach. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Peter. Do the panel want to come back straight away on any of those questions, or would you like to pick them up at the end? It looks like. Well, maybe while they're fresh in people's minds, if we've got some comments, it would be best to.
Okay, I mean, I can offer you comments on some of those things that you raise. Clearly, in terms of the calibration points that you raise, SIOPS will provide advice to the Commission, and there's work ongoing in that on those particular things. There will be particular calibrations, obviously, tested out in Quiz 3, although I suspect that Quiz 3 may not be the last that you hear on that, and there may well be a Quiz 4 sometime in 2008. That said, of course, Solvency II is a negotiation process, and the equity risk stress is recognised as a particularly sort of sensitive issue within Solvency II, and I don't doubt that it will probably come up in negotiating discussions between the various finance ministries. Now, I mean, clearly CEOPS will provide its advice, but where that discussion will come out longer term, it's hard to say. You raised another point, I think, on technical provisions, and in particular on whether long-tail liabilities would be subject to the cost of capital approach, or whether they've been carved out of that. I think perhaps a more accurate characterisation of where that discussion is that they're still under consideration, and whether that, you know, whether the cost of capital approach is the right approach is still being debated. So it's not quite right to say that they've been carved out, and you may well find that they ultimately get carved back in, but that's an ongoing discussion.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Who would like to make the next contribution? Yes, Annette,
would you? Hi, Annette Olson. My question relates to internal models, which has been mentioned, I think, by all of the speakers tonight. I think it's extremely important part, particularly from an actuarial professional's perspective. And I'm sort of aware that there potentially is a big win here because the standard approach might be calibrated quite high, and unlike what we're used to in ICAS, where maybe the ECR is lower where the ICA comes out, it would be a sort of different relationship with Solvency II is what's expected. So big win, but also I've heard the FSA recently saying that one cannot assume, like from a UK professions perspective or from a UK as an industry perspective, that their current ICAS models would actually meet the approval process. Perhaps a few, I should say, to be fair to the speaker at the FSA, but it would be very few that would perhaps meet that. I think this is clearly implementing measures and more will be developed on it, but I would be interested in what the UK industry should be thinking about at this point in time in relation to the ICAS models. Is it around the actual models, or is it about the control frameworks surrounding them?
Okay. Perhaps I can offer you a little bit of information on what's currently in the draft Level 1 Directive text, which is obviously quite high level and quite principles based. But as you suggest, there's a kind of substantial bit of work going forward for CEOPS in terms of developing and implementing measure on what the model approval process will be, which will include, obviously, you know, effectively, what do those high-level principles mean in terms of, you know, whether you pass or fail the test. In terms of the Level 1 text, it is quite high-level and quite principles-based, which from a UK perspective, or at least from the FSA perspective, we think is quite a good thing. It envisages a number of tests. There is the so-called use test, which will be pretty key, which effectively looks at whether the firm uses the model that generates the regulatory number in actually running its business and making its business and risk management and capital allocation decisions. Now, that's not to say that would be the only thing they would think about, but, you know, that would form, obviously, a part of that. There will be a calibration standard. Now, that calibration standard is framed very much like the ICAS calibration standard, so you will need to generate a regulatory number that meets the 99.5 confidence level. However, that doesn't mean, you know, it is recognised that firms may target other confidence levels or indeed use a tail VaR measure rather than a VaR measure for their own purposes. It's just that for generating the regulatory capital number, you have to demonstrate that meets the Solvency II calibration standard. In addition, there is what's called the statistical quality test, or sort of words to that effect, which will clearly look at sort of completeness and appropriateness and adequacy of data, modelling assumptions, and all of that will be in there. But firms, there will also be an examination of the governance and controls that surround the model. So how does the firm itself ensure that that there's good understanding of the model and, you know, what it does well and what its weaknesses are, change controls, you know, what is the sort of board level understanding of the model, etc., etc. There's quite a lot in that space. And clearly the firm will also need to have a sort of regular process of model validation so that it ensures for itself that the model has reasonable predictive ability. And clearly the model approval process will look at all of those things together in the round. Now, there is quite a lot of discussion about how different that is from ICAS and what sort of gap firms will have to bridge. I think, to be fair, I mean, that's going to be a road that we'll have to travel together, and the FSA is very willing to work with the industry ahead of Solvency II implementation for those firms that are keen to seek model approval. But to sort of give you a few pointers, I mean, I think there are some things that are coming out of, that have come out of ICAS and that are clearly going to be worked on further within the ICAS process as we go forward from here. And one of those things is the extent to which firms have embedded ICAS within their decision-making frameworks. And that clearly will vary from firm to firm, but I think, you know, probably generally there is a little way to go there. But clearly I think the sort of the possibly the thing that will take up a lot of time and resource is more around validating the model itself. But one thing I did mention in relation to quiz three is, I mean, you might recall I said we would be keen to get internal model numbers in for calibration purposes. But I think that would also give firms an opportunity, you know, to enter into a dialogue with the FSA and kind of begin to benchmark where they are today compared to where they might need to be. And that obviously can only be best, you know, based on our best expectations of where the implementing measure will come out, and that will play out over time. But that will be very informative, obviously, in terms of, you know, FSA input into the development of that implementing measure.
Okay, just to add to that, The process you've described, Sarah, sounds very similar to the model approval process under Basel II for banks.
Yeah.
And I've been quite involved in that in my employer, and it strikes me as though there's probably some benefit in getting to know some people who've worked on Basel projects to find out what processes they've been through to get their ICAP models approved, and think about what we can learn from them. There's no point reinventing the wheel.
Thank you very much. Right, who would like to go next? Yes.
Hi, I'm Lee Faulkner. I'm jumping ahead a bit to Pillar 3. The notes, the briefing notes for this session said that the intention is to give more accessible and meaningful public disclosure than at present in the UK, and one of the items would be business strategy. How are you proposing to stop that leading to anti-competitive behaviour?
People are looking at me. I'm not sure that it's up to me to stop that.
I thought you might be bored with listening to me.
It'll give Sarah a break, rather than sort of a Sarah Varney entertainment. an audience with Sarah Varney, that's it. No, I mean, it's a good question. And if you're interested in this, what you want to read is it CP16? Is that the disclosure one or CP15?
I think it's 15.
15, thanks very much. CP15 set out the proposals from CEOPS. They've now had the responses in, and they've given their final view to the Commission, and you'll find that on the Group Consultative website if you can't find the CEOPS website. What's also worth reading, I think, would be DP7, which was a discussion paper that the FSA produced in, I think, 2001 or 2002, which discussed what regulated reporting could look like in the future from the perspective of various different stakeholders. I think these documents are well aware that there is a competitive advantage point that firms won't want to lose, but the definition of commerciality may not be strong enough yet. So it's a good point that you make. I suspect that firms won't be oblivious to that, and we risk then bland disclosure. But maybe we'll end up somewhere in the middle.
So is there anything?
I can add a little if you'd like. If you can just bear with me. In addition to what CEOPS has put in CP15, which is obviously what's in the public domain, there is under development, obviously, some level one text at the moment. And incorporated within that, and indeed in a slightly different guise within CP15, there is what's known as the Solvency and Financial Condition Report, which is intended, as you rightly say, to be publicly disclosed. And that will require some information along the lines that you suggest. Now, exactly what shape that will take, any degree of detail really on that has yet to be developed, and clearly, you know, there will be further CEOPS consultations on that topic. But one thing that it is worth noting is recognised is that to the extent that there is already relevant public disclosures under international financial reporting, for example, those can be cross-referred to. So Solvency II is not trying to duplicate, if you like, information that's pre-existing elsewhere, but getting that balance right and getting the sort of public-private balance right clearly will be very critical to the Solvency II Pillar 3 debate going forward.
Thank you very much. Who's next? Yes.
Mark Chaplin. This one's probably for the whole panel, so to give Sarah a break. Two issues. One hasn't really been mentioned so far, but I believe it's been a point of discussion across Europe, and that's what other insurance liabilities or non-insurance liabilities should be included in the solvency capital requirement calculation and in what way. I understand that the CEA at one point had pushed for excluding all liabilities, which was rebutted by CEOPS, perhaps understandably, and in particular things like staff pension schemes and how they should be allowed for in the solvency capital assessment. And the second one is, Sarah mentioned that the MCR, there's currently a debate as to whether it should be calculated using a very compact approach referencing the SCR, or percentage of the SCR, or using a factor-based formula calibrated to, I believe, a 90% VAR over 1 year. It would be useful to understand the panel's views in comparison to CEOPS' slight majority view for the factor-based approach as to whether the compact approach is better, and if so, why. And secondly, if a calibration standard of 90% at 90% confidence level over 1 year is correct, in particular whether 1 year is right and whether 90% confidence level
is right,
appropriate.
No, you're right, that's right, yeah.
Right, a few questions there. Who's going to have first go?
Okay, well, he's not done one yet.
Would you like?
Yes. Well, I don't know if I got well your first question, but therefore I will begin with the second one. At the beginning of Solvency II, when the group consultative has been asked concerning the MCR, how should the MCR be calculated, we immediately proposed a percentage of the SCR would be the best way. This was a pure actuarial answer, because we know if the percentage is less than 100%, then the MCR will certainly be smaller than the SCR. And this is very simple. If you make another formula, you never know. And this was one of the results of QAS2. And if you take a simplified formula for the MCR, what's one of the proposals now for the EQS3? By the way, EQS3, this one is asked, and SEOPS told us that in any case, they will also calculate a percentage of the SCR, but this they can do on their own, of course. If you take a simplified formula, you have always the problem how to get to a kind of 90%, whatever it is now, value at risk, because you must omit some risks, and then obviously your standard MCR formula is even more standard than the SCR is already standardized and standard and bad in the sense and not valuing correctly the risks, the underlying risks, which is always the problem. But this is certainly a kind of, of balancing out something. I don't know what the solution will be. This depends certainly also on the results of QS3. In your second part, there was another question, I think, but I didn't got it.
Non-insurance liability.
The non-insurance liability, yes, this was the first part, I think. I didn't understand what you mean with this. Sorry, I didn't get it.
Perhaps someone else would like to try.
Would you like me to have a crack at that?
Yeah, okay, thanks.
I think your question is to the extent that there are other liabilities on the balance sheet besides technical provisions, to what extent should those be stressed by the SCR? Is that the question? Yeah. I think that there's an ongoing discussion on that. The Commission is very keen on a sort of whole balance sheet approach with sort of no particular simplifications on the basis that ensures that firms that are on internal models and firms that are on standard formula are treated on a like-for-like basis. But I think exactly how that all works and to what extent, for example, pensions liabilities and other liabilities might be stressed by the standard formula or indeed, in theory, as well as in practice, that's all still to run. You'll see a particular treatment in Quiz 3, for example, but I think it's fair to say that discussions are still ongoing between the Commission and SEOPS on these points. You raised also a point about the MCR, and in particular on the so-called modular approach. Perhaps I could just give you a few comments on why it is, and I'm not saying these are views that I actually personally subscribe to or that the FSA necessarily subscribes to, but, points that have been made in favour of a compact approach, which you might potentially then dispute, because I think it's always easier to put an argument forward against something if you know what the supposed points in favour are. There are a number. One is clearly that some supervisors and indeed some finance ministries have some sort of concerns about moving to an unknown, untried, untested Solvency II system with a relatively sophisticated SCR which requires supervisory judgment. And therefore what they want is a reasonably simple and sort of legally defensible MCR formula, and they think they have that delivered better by a modular approach. One other argument that's been put in favour of the modular approach over the sort of percentage of the fraction of the SCR is that if you apply a fraction to the SCR, that doesn't give you a uniform confidence level across different firms. And therefore, the assumption is that if you calibrate each of the MCR modules to the desired confidence level, that gives you a better approximation of the 90% confidence level from firm to firm. One third aspect to the debate is how it all plays out in the group's context, and in particular in the context of the UK group's proposal that many of you may have heard discussed, which, I mean, and just to recap on what the UK group's proposal is in a nutshell, that says if you're going to assess a group capital requirement that takes account of group-level diversification benefits, then it would be much simpler if you had a supervision system based on the lead supervisor model, and then therefore the group SCR amount of capital would be calculated and held at group level, and for the solo entities within the group, they would obviously hold their technical provisions, and then over and above that they would hold their minimum capital requirement. So clearly in that context, you know, what the level of the MCR is and how it's calculated and the degree to which the solo supervisor relies on the group supervisor or indeed the group model for that number is quite sensitive. One further thing to add in sort of respect of the compact approach, one particular area of discussion there is whether that third or whatever it is of the SCR would be based on the SCR standard approach or whether it would be based on an internal modelled number. But clearly it's, you know, of paramount importance that for the coherence of the framework overall that the relationship of the MCR and the SCR is, you know, is predictable and the MCR is well behaved. But that debate will run.
Thank you very much. Catherine, do you want to?
Yeah, I was just going to add that I think your question shows how much there is still to debate on Solvency II and how important it is to engage now. And because there's so much, what my working group's been doing is focusing our effort on certain key things that we think are the key actuarial things. And it would be quite helpful to get feedback on whether those are the right ones. And I think just a final thing is, as was the case in Life on Mars last week, God is in the detail. And I think it would be quite annoying to get to the end of Solvency II and discover that we'd missed something quite major. So it is important to engage at quite a detailed level on all the proposals.
Very good. David, I don't want you to feel left out on this question. Is there anything you want to add?
Just to say, I think it's well appreciated that there's a danger of a Twin Peaks regime surviving into Solvency II if you have an MCR that moves in a different way to the SCR. And that was particularly the case with profit sharing business in Quest 2. And unless we're got careful, it will be the case again. So one ray of hope, I heard of one office that when they worked out their MCR on the Quest 3 pretest approach, they ended up with a negative number, so maybe it's not as bad as I feel.
Martin White.
Martin White. First, I would like to echo Peter Wright's comments about the reality of the non-life tail. But my main point is to do with the harmonisation and sharing of knowledge. I was very interested to hear Rolf's comments about the group consultative initiative to examine proxy values as part of the harmonisation of technical provisions. I think this offers plenty of scope for actuaries for different countries to work together, and I would hope to see more representatives of European companies at future JARA conferences. Finally, I'd be keen to hear Rolf's thoughts on the extent to which the big European reinsurers can feed their knowledge of the different conditions existing in the different insurance markets, especially the small countries where I would expect there to be a greater reliance on reinsurance. Thank you.
Well, your question concerning the different, the big players in the European market, if they can't help for this big problem concerning the technical provisions. This is a long story which I experienced myself when I wanted to build up a group on technical provisions within our project. only for non-life, because life, you may have to separate life and non-life there, because for life, the problem is quite different. For life, you normally have always sufficient actuarial knowledge, and normally have sufficient data. Therefore, it's normally a non-life problem. And in non-life, we asked, the group consultative asked all the national actuarial associations if they didn't want to send some experienced non-life reserving actuaries to this group, and there was no answer at all. Therefore, I had, as a big reinsurer, we have some clients, and then I looked at the big clients in the big countries, and I took up my phone and I asked my colleagues, of course, to whom I could phone, and then I got some actuaries from these big clients in four countries, by then, in France, UK, and Germany, it was, in order to build up a small group at the beginning, which has now been merged on the especially part of the UK in the last group consultative meeting, merged to the Pillar One group. But this is a problem of the, a problem of the actuaries in general, of the actuarial associations, of the institute, the faculty, to name the UK institutions, also, of course, of the other actuarial associations, to get really experienced actuaries. And you need a lot of experience from the big companies. And within the big companies, the non-life actuaries are completely underwater normally. I see with Munich Re and Allianz, other companies I know, they have a lot of things to do. It's, with the new IAS and IFRS regulations, they have even more work to do. And there are not enough, at least, I cannot speak for UK now, but on the continent, there are certainly not enough non-life actuaries. There's a shortage of them. And this is a big problem. And therefore, I have no answer to your question, but you're right, this is a big problem. And therefore, once again, we decided as Group Constructive to help to build, even as actuaries, to help with this proxy approach, even if it's highly non-actuarial, as we know. But we need in order to make it not too worse, we need the actuarial knowledge to be put in there.
Very good. Thank you very much for that. Yes, Peter.
Peter Copeman, a couple of questions for our panelists. Firstly, returning to internal models, I wondered if our panelists would like to hazard a guess as to what proportion of companies they would expect to be using internal models, and also either in total or in part, and whether that would vary by size of company and maybe country. And secondly, really allied to that, I was very interested in Dr. Stirling's comments on the harmonisation being the number one objective, and I think that is clearly a very challenging objective. If part of this is to do with regulators approving internal models, I mean, it strikes me that the experiences we have in the UK is that is not a straightforward process. It requires a lot of resource and a lot of training and experience in that. Is there a scope here for some regulatory arbitrage? Because I can't see that all the countries across Europe are going to be able to do that in the same way at the moment.
Yes?
Yes. Your question concerning the internal models, what proportion of companies will use internal models? I think nobody can answer this question because nobody knows what an internal model is, how this will be defined. And as an actuary, you need first of all the definition, then you can begin to discuss. That's the case, nobody knows. Maybe it's worth to mention here the work on the IAA side, the International Actuarial Associations, in the Insurance Regulation Committee. There was a request from the IAIS, the International Association of the Insurance Supervisors, to work out a kind of guidance paper on internal models. And the first draft will be discussed now in, well, the first one and a half first draft will be discussed in the next IA meeting in Mexico next month. And this work has also been, CIOPS is aware of it, of course, also been announced to the EU, and they are very keen to get an actuarial guidance paper, guidance note on internal models, because we need some ground for the discussion. Well, not we, the EU, the lawmakers, and CIOPS need something that they can rely on. But this is an open question. Only some characteristics, as Sarah mentioned already, are known and are obvious, the use tests and so on and so on, but it's not clear how sophisticated an internal model should be. Therefore, no answer to the question partial, non-partial, or what is the proportion, no idea. The harmonization is, of course, once again, depending on the definition, but the harmonization, well, I can only guess once again. I don't know how solvency 2 will work, and the Lamfalussy process, if you know it, there are not only the different levels, but there's a kind of loop with the fourth level where it's going back to the EU Commission, and they will look at it, and they will see, okay, there are different applications of some, or interpretations of solvency 2 rules, and then they will come back and then they will ask the different supervisors to adjust the interpretation. And I think for autonomous models this will probably be the case, because nobody can stop everything, and everybody must have some experience with it, and I think this is the kind this will work. This is my guess.
Your point about harmonisation, I mean, I think that it's really good that the European Commission has this goal. You've got to have something to aim towards, haven't you? And in terms of internal models, I think it would be good to think that companies use them because they wanted to, because they added value and they gave them a good understanding of the risks in their organisation, and it was a good business reason to do it, rather than just being pushed into it for Solvency II. So I'd quite like to see 100%, but I think I'm probably being a bit optimistic there.
Thank you very much. Who would like to ask the next question or make the next comment? Yes, John Ryan.
I'd just like to ask some questions. I'm just not sure I just missed the point, but I think the banking models have very similar structure without using internal models that came in. And my understanding is that that's worked fine. And therefore, presumably, the FSA and they have a lot of experience about that. Is it possible to give us some guidance about how many of the banks came up with their internal models and came in that direction? And also, presumably, since that's been harmonised, and certainly there seems to be more banking cross-border mergers and so on going through, and no regulatory arbitrage in that way, presumably the problems about harmonisation will solve in that respect.
Okay.
If you give us any guidance on that, that would be very helpful.
I mean, I can offer you a couple of comments that draw parallels to CRD. I mean, clearly, from an FSA perspective, we will use our CRD experience in terms of, you know, model approval processes and all that, or at least bear that in mind in terms of developing the insurance implementing measure, and also in terms of actually, you know, preparing, working with firms ahead of the date at which Solvency II switches on to ensure that, you know, if they want model approval from day one and they meet the required standards, that we're in a position to offer that. Now, I mean, there are a number of parallels with the CRD that are worth noting. So one idea that there is within the CRD that is likely to be carried across to Solvency II is that in a group context where a group is seeking internal model approval, the group supervisor or the parent supervisor and the supervisors of the subsidiaries work together so that there is a single approval process, and there's also a certain amount in there about, you know, what happens if the supervisors can't agree. But clearly, you know, in terms of getting a shared understanding and sort of consistent application between supervisors, there's much more work that needs to go on above and beyond that, and there will doubtless be further work within CEOPS, both on the level 2 implementing measure and on level 3 guidance and how that is applied. But, you know, we're mindful, very mindful, of the process that's been gone through on the banking side. I mean, to be clear, on the banking side, the models are allowed in sort of 2 contexts. 1, well, indeed 3. For some time, obviously, firms have been allowed to model the market risk in their trading books. More recently, under Basel 2 / CRD, they can now model their credit risk. And they can also adopt what's called the advanced approach on operational risk. Now, there's, I suppose, a relatively high degree of prescription within CRD about how firms can go about modelling their credit risk. And a rather higher degree of modelling freedom in relation to operational risk. My guess, and it is only a guess at this stage, is that Solvency II will probably come somewhere between those two in terms of how much freedom it offers firms and to what extent it sort of sets down parameters. The other point that I was going to make is that there's clearly a big difference between Solvency II and CRD in the respect that banks can model specific risks. They can model their market risk, they can model their credit risk, they can model their operational risk, but they can't have a whole capital model. And that clearly will be possible under Solvency II. So, you know, what Solvency II is envisaging is a step beyond, quite a big step beyond, where CRD has got to. And to that extent, you can't draw a parallel between Basel CRD and Solvency II. And, you know, we'll have to work out that gap between us.
Yes, please.
First of all, can you imagine the programme committee on getting the date right? The 17th anniversary of the largest insolvency in the London market. And out of that came operational risk. And I was wondering what actually was being done on that. And then just one other final point. It's actually encouraged people to do something on smaller tests than standard benchmarking. For part of my career, I have looked at benchmarking type things, from an analyst point of view, in the early days of doing that. And in fact, you can get quite a good idea fairly easily on whether a company is underreserved or not by using some fairly basic rules. They're not necessarily precise, and there will always be exceptions. And I think the US authorities have done something with our tests. So I would encourage people to go down that, particularly in some of those areas. And you can translate those fairly easily, as I've done with some doing with companies, in terms of as well as a limited amount of area. So I think it is an area that will go through. It is going to be a nightmare to try and put it in from a legislative point of view to try and say, well, you know, there's some surprising challenges in it, but rough test and that sort of thing, I think, was very good.
Thank you very much. Did you want to comment on that? No?
Well, I mean, I can say a little bit about the treatment of operational risk within the Solvency II framework. I mean, clearly there's a Pillar 2 dimension to that. So, you know, there will be a supervisory focus on, qualitatively, how well is that managed. Now, in addition, obviously, there is a Pillar 1 aspect. And there will be a capital requirement, or at least there will be a module within the solvency capital requirement that relates to operational risk. And that will necessarily be a fairly blunt tool, but it makes the point, I think, that capital needs to be held against that risk, that operational risk can, of course, be a source of losses. And it also hopefully sets the incentive for firms to model it and measure it better. So there is obviously the option for firms to model that for themselves. But if you have any particular, you know, observations on it, you know, exactly how the SCR assesses the capital requirement for operational risk, you'll need to watch obviously the quiz 3 space.
Maybe just a small remark. The operational risk with the insurance company, I would not hinder somebody to do some modeling work on it. But if there are free capacities, I think there are other things which are at least so important as operational risk to model as within insurance companies. I think the operational risk for banks is by far more important than for insurance companies and probably better known. In insurance companies, we are just at the beginning to build up a database, for example. We are just, once again, also beginning to define what is the operational risks. It's difficult to define. And on the other side, there are risks like the technical provisions, like the technical risks, the capital risks, which are probably, if you get a little bit more precision in these in the modeling of these risks within your internal model, you get a lot more than if you have, well, intelligent thoughts on the operational risk. Once again, I don't want to say this is not important, but I think if you see the effort and the result, probably you invest this in other types of risks for the time being. That's what I want to say.
Yes, would you like to say something about the ABI's work in this area?
Yvonne Braun, ABI. Two comments and one question. First, to just reiterate the importance of taking part in Quiz 3 and basically reinforce what Sarah said and other speakers have said. And I think it's very important to also take seriously what CEOs have said in their specification. And it's supposed to happen on a best efforts basis. We at the ABI, together with one of the large consultancy firms, are doing, I've already done some seminars in March, but doing some in-depth seminars in April, 16th and 17th for non-life and 23rd and 24th for life, so we can extend an invitation. It's a fee-paying event, but you can get more information also on the ABI website. And that's one of the ways we hope to encourage greater participation from the UK industry. We will also have actuarial resource actually at the ABI because we have an actuary seconded to the ABI from about mid-April with quite a lot of experience on Quiz 2. So we'll publish that and you can call in and ask him questions. On operational risk, I'd just like to get back what you said, Dr. Störting. While it's fair to say that the insurance sector is, I think, at the beginning of that operational risk journey, the ABI has done quite a lot of work on an external database for operational risk. It's called ORIC, Operational Risk Industry Consortium, and it actually uses the Basel categories for operational risk. And it's been going now for about a year and a half, and it covers more than 50% of the sector, both for life and general insurance in the UK. To the question, also a question on harmonisation, really. I picked up last week at the FSA's insurance sector conference a comment from Dr. Steffen, who's of course now the chairman of CEOPS, that whilst for Pillar 1 there would be maximum harmonisation, there might not be quite as high a level of harmonisation on Pillar 2. And I just wondered whether there was perhaps a danger that in the end the supervision of insurers Europe-wide might actually remain quite different. And I was curious in your comments on that.
Well, I think on pillar two that remains to be seen, and I was at that conference and I heard Dr. Steffen's comments as well. Nevertheless, I mean, just to say my perceptions of the draft commission text that's emerging, they're clearly envisaging quite a high level of harmonisation.
Well, from my side, I can only repeat, a formula is easier to harmonise,
yeah,
or the application of the formula is easier to harmonise than the in-depth approval of an internal model, for example. You need by far more knowledge to approve an internal model, which is pillar two, and then to see how a formula is applied, the SCR formula. And therefore, I think, once again, for pillar two, there will be this loop process, and this will take some years, of course. That's, once again, what I'm thinking about this question, but certainly pillar two cannot be immediately so harmonized than pillar one. It's, for me, very simple. It's about human beings.
Right, I think that's probably a good place to leave it. We had four objectives for this evening's meeting: to raise awareness of Solvency II, I think we've done that, to raise awareness of the group's work in achieving European consensus, I think we've done that, to give you a chance to express your views. Well, I guess we've had more questions than we've had views, but nevertheless a very good discussion. And the fourth one was to encourage participation in Quiz 3, and I hope that you have been encouraged to participate in Quiz 3. It's clear that there's still quite a long way to go in resolving some aspects of Solvency 2, and I think we will get a much better system at the end of it if more companies are willing to participate in the impact studies. So it really just remains for me to express my thanks, and I'm sure the thanks of all of you, for our panellists this evening, for giving us the benefit of their clearly very extensive knowledge on the subject of Solvency II, and to thank also all of those who participated in the discussion. Can we show our appreciation? For those of you who did have prepared notes, it would help those preparing the transcript of the discussion for the British Actuarial Journal if you would hand them to either Pauline Simpson or Maria Lyons at the back of the hall as you leave the meeting. The next sessional meeting of the Institute of Actuaries will take place at 5 o'clock on Monday the 30th of April 2007 at the Lowry Salford Quays in Manchester, where I think we will be the guests of the Northwest Actuarial Society, and where a discussion on modelling and managing risk will take place. And I'd now like to invite you all to join me in continuing tonight's discussion over a glass of wine in the Council Chamber. And just to help with the logistics, could those people who are seated in the Council Chamber please pick up their chairs and remove them from the sides of the room to allow the drinks reception to proceed. I now declare the meeting closed. Thank you very much.